One, two. One, two. Are we ready?
Thank you. A colleague, let me welcome everyone, honorable members, and the entire delegation from the department. You are heartily welcomed, and we have Office of the Auditor General. They are also welcomed. I think we'll know which way when we introduce each other correctly. Let me just start by myself. My name is Matomi Humphrey Mohobi, the chairperson of Select Committee. Then I'll request members to do the same.
Tunga Matilo, a member of the committee from Gauteng.
Good morning. I'm Chantemo Fugain, member of the committee from the Free State.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve Bidesfeld. I'm member of the committee from the Western Cape.
Thank you, honorable member. Let's just take it that way.
I'm Lebogang Oveka. I'm also from Cooperative Ministry.
Good morning. My name is Nozipho Gwaza. I'm the Parliamentary Officer in the Office of the Public Service Commission. Noma Wetukale from Stalga.
Morning, everyone. My name is Vyokazima Filika from the Office of the Auditor General.
Morning, members. I'm Paul Musaka. I'm from the Auditor General.
Morning, everyone. My name is Nene from Palama.
Okay. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nkosinathi Ntlaigwa. I'm from the Department of Public Service and Administration, responsible for the Special Anti-Corruption Unit. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Stephen Mushokwane. I'm from Palama, responsible for training delivery.
My name is Solimolo. I'm the Director General of Palama.
Good morning. I'm Surya. I'm from Palama.
Good morning. Morning, my name is Alex Mahapa from DPSA.
Morning, Chair, honorable members, and everybody else. My name is Lynette Singh from the Department of Public Service and Administration, the Governance and International Relations Branch. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members and the House and everybody else. My name is Colette Clark, responsible for service delivery and organizational transformation, the Department of Public Service and Administration. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Ngosana Mvuko. I'm a parliamentary staff member working to assist the government.
Okay, thank you very much. Now we know each other, except that the honorable one, Comrade.
Good morning, Chairperson in the House. Apologies for being late. I'm Bonisile Nesi, a member of the committee from the Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Chair, I just want to make an apology on behalf of Honorable Watson. He's busy with selection committees.
Is there any other apologies from other members?
I beg your pardon?
No, I'm saying, is there any other apologies?
Sorry.
Thank you. I think it's accepted.
Minister for Public Service and Administration as well as the Deputy Minister were unable to attend, as well as the Director General, and we are tendering the apologies.
The apologies for Minister, the Deputy, and the Director General are held up. I think we can go on. Onesi?
Whether she says they are written down, because we said last time at least they must be written down. So I didn't hear that part.
Both of them are not written down, from the Honorable and from the Minister.
Just Chairperson to say, next time, remember last time we have said it is important for them to be written down. So can we request again that the department at least, when they are this, we understand that there are many things, but it's right when they are formalized. Thank you, Chairperson.
I think the message will reach the head. Thank you very much.
Just on this issue, Chair, I think it is important that we send this message that attending to committees' requests is very important, and we hope they're not doing this for undermining the committee, because next time we'll send this delegation picking. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think the message is heard. The message is heard. Thank you very much. Let me throw you to the agenda. But before the agenda, I want to register the concern also as a Chairperson that we communicate this meeting somewhere the 28th February, and we wanted the department to be forwarding us with document earlier so that members could be able to read in order to engage properly. And also that in our committee we have one honorable member who use what you call blinds, braille. And then if we don't have documents in time, it's difficult to prepare for such. It just to say, this is the department that takes the issues of disability very high. And as we request documentary, we really want your cooperation in time. Maybe there might be technicality for communication, but what I know is that the communication was out on the 28th February. It's just that which must be noted. The other thing is that the last time we met, we agreed on quarterly report. Maybe both of us, we didn't do the way. Both the committee and the department, we didn't communicate. I can't blame the department. We also had to initiate a meeting of quarterly report or even submission of what we prioritized that time. And then maybe this year we need to improve so that we don't only meet towards approving the budget. We must also know what are the development after we have approved budget. What is it that is happening? What is it that is not happening? And we would also engage the department, particularly on our oversight visit, after we shall have received your annual budget briefing. I believe there will be issues that will be cropping out of that annual budget briefing that will inform us to oversee certain things, to monitor certain things, so that we are able to see that budget that we pass to ministry are indeed doing what is expected it to do, but that will only be after we receive that annual budget. And we would request, as we go to that meeting of annual budget, to get documents in time, because if you are, you know, that those with high IQs, some of us we have low IQs, we need to read repeatedly in order to engage on issues. So if we could get that document of budget votes in time, I don't know when, but we'll communicate so that members are able to read, that will be very fine. Those are just few remarks that I wanted both of us to note going forward. So on the agenda there we have welcome with those who it serves as welcome. And the meeting is declared open. I would go to item two. If you could check, most of the issues are updated, which means you are not going to be that comprehensive. You are just going to give us updates on this issue. We are here, or this is the challenge. On this one, we are here. This is the challenge. Maybe the meeting will adjourn quicker than expected. If we go, we go that way. So that's the request that I would want to make. I would then request, I don't know who leads, or the person that will present on the anti-corruption unit, you can take the stage. Go on. Thank you very much.
Chair, just to beg your indulgence, we had initially asked before starting before the meeting started, that if we could be allowed that the leader of our delegation gives an overall sort of overview around the Department of Public Service and Administration, and then flow from there into the specific sort of divisions. And then the question of the special anti-corruption will also fall there within. So would they just ask that we would, with your permission, Chair.
All right, as long as the overview is not the state of the department address, I will come.
Thank you, Chair. I think thanks to Mr. Nkleko and to the honourable members. The apologies from our side in terms of not having the documents ready. There was a logistical problem with regards to the notification, and I think we'd have to sort those logistics out when we get back to the office. But we do give an undertaking that in terms of the documents for the budget vote, we would ensure that those would be here on time. With that, what had happened is that the invitation that we had received yesterday, the presentation had flowed from the topics that had been on the presentation. And we won't be going into the functioning of the department per se, but basically the flow of what the items were. You had asked us to deal with the updates on the single public service, which DPSA will be giving you an update on. On the CDWs, DPSA will also be doing that, and the implementation and update on the Batipile principles, the policies. There was an issue of Palama on the invitation, but I don't see it on the agenda, so we had included it initially on the presentation, so we'd be guided by you in relation to whether that presentation is still required for the briefing. And then the anti-corruption unit, DPSA, and then an update on the preparations for the 2011 salary negotiations. So if we could just be guided on the Palama issue, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. I think I will personally speak to my committee secretary, because those issues were supposed to be as accurate. Now you are correcting us. You see, this is wrong. We will deal with him when you are gone. You can include whatever you have received. Just do the way you have received that. It's our errors on our side, and we'll also see how we correct each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. With that, what I'll do is hand over to the presenter, who will then deal with the update on the single public service. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just in terms of the presentation, we'll do a very brief background introduction, a country perspective on a single public service. We'll remind everybody about the SPS mission, the strategic objectives, and then zoom in specifically on the way forward for the 2011-2012. So it's about where are we currently and what is the way forward. And included in the presentation, I'll talk to a process map to Parliament. As a reminder, in terms of the introduction, the broad goal of establishing a single public service It's about aligning and harmonizing the machinery of state across the three spheres so as to more effectively fulfill service delivery needs. The argument is made that an integrated public service with harmonious systems, conditions of service and norms will reduce fragmentation and promote more efficient coordination between the different spheres of government. The other issue that underpins the move towards a single public service is this issue of mobility, the mobility of staff between the spheres, thereby facilitating optimal deployment of skills and then also supporting the allocation of function and the transfer of functions across the spheres. In this regard, the SPS is seen as that vehicle that will enhance and augment government's capacity across the three spheres to improve and accelerate service delivery, which ultimately is the key thing that cuts across all of the outcomes of government. And in our view, the mechanism that will allow for this framework is the legislation on a single public service that underpins and supports all of these goals. Where did we come from and where are we now? There was a draft palm bill, Chair, that was developed, and the objective of that bill was to provide for the organization, the management, the functioning, and personnel-related matters in the administration in the three spheres of government. That was prepared, it was consulted upon, and it was introduced in Parliament in June 2008. That bill then was subsequently withdrawn in November 2008 by our current minister. What he needed to do was to ensure an extended extra parliamentary consultation process. We might also say that as part of the consultations that led to the tabling of the bill in Parliament, there was one area that was a bit of a challenge, and that was the NEDLAC processes. So that process was started, but it was not concluded. So the minister wants to correct that situation and ensure that in terms of the processes of consultation this time, that we cover that base well. I think we also had a timing issue that the bill was tabled in Parliament at a point which would have crossed the terms of different legislative and executive authorities. So we were heading into the elections and a bill was on the table. And in that regard, it was felt, let us rather remove it from Parliament, give the new administration and executive a chance to relook at these things and then go through a process of retabling. And the decision that was also taken back home was that we had to move towards the reintroduction of the bill. But let us first sort out various issues at different levels. Some context, just to say constitutional imperatives. The Constitution does provide that South Africa is one sovereign democratic state and that government is constituted as national, provincial, and local spheres of government, which are distinctive, interdependent, and interrelated. And this is where Chapter 3 comes in and talks about cooperative governance. And all of that is ultimately saying that whilst we have the system of government, which is a quasi-federal system, at the end of the day, it is a unitary state. The Constitution also, well, determines basic values and principles governing public administration, and one is trying through a legislative process to underpin that and to entrench those values and principles. Constitution is saying that all spheres of government must provide effective, efficient, transparent, accountable, and coherent government to secure the well-being of the people and then the progressive realization of their fundamental human rights and constitutional rights. Following on with the country perspective, in that regard...
Can I just chip in? Can't we deal with challenges and where we are? Because we know this background.
Sure.
That's why I requested that we focus on where we are, what is the challenges. Thank you.
Chair, certainly. What we will do then is move to the last two slides, which talk about the way forward, 2011-2012, the process map to Parliament. And in terms of that, we've mapped out all of the activities, and we've also put down some timelines there, which we are going to adhere to as best as we can. But also just to say that while DPSA drives this process, it is going to be done in full consultation and in collaboration with key partners across government. And there you are looking at the Department of Cooperative Governance, SALGA, your National Treasury, and to some extent the Public Service Commission. We had task teams that we'd established under the previous processes, and all of those will be in the process of revitalization. Work will then commence to prepare the first draft amendment bill. There is really a debate about, do we come and introduce a brand new piece of legislation as was the previous process, or do we look at existing pieces of legislation where the authorities are vested and do lie and seek to amend those pieces of legislation. So that is the debate that will happen within government. Is it a new piece of legislation, or do we look at existing pieces of legislation and then legislate and regulate as was envisaged in the Palm Bill? And in that respect, that consultation process with stakeholders within government, I've mentioned them, cooperative governance, National Treasury, the President, I forgot about the SALGA, to commence, and that is the timeline there. We will then go through a process collectively within government to finalize that draft amendment bill. And there we're envisaging, Chair, around about June of this year. Any legislation that impacts or affects local government has to be published in terms of the Constitution, and we will have to go through that process. This is no shortcuts, Chairperson. We, in terms of the consultation, must make sure that we cover all our bases. In parallel to that, we will also then notify NEDLAC and then commence a process of consultation with external stakeholders. Once we've been through that process of border country consultation, we'll consider, comment, and revise the draft amendment bill. That will need some time, and it takes us to September 2011. Then the processes in NEDLAC start. There will be a formal process there. We'll engage on the revised draft amendment bill. And we will also deliberate on what are the best structures, because at certain points there were sort of working groups and teams within NEDLAC around this matter. We've given ourselves from September to October 2011 to do that work. So that means that all parties have to be prepared in advance for that in order to meet that timeline. Then, of course, getting back into the government and its legislative processes, there will have to be pre-cabinet certification by the state law advisors. That takes us to the end of the calendar year, and then submitting all of this now to cabinet for cabinet's approval to introduce this in parliament. And once we pass that step, certification for introduction in parliament by the state law advisors, and then we are on the road to parliament, which is February 2012. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. I think this is the core of what the committee would want to know, because we've been engaged in asking questions every time we meet, not only in the public administration, also in COCTA, because we have noted that COCTA also has got a stake in terms of this one. So we wanted to know where we are. I would now allow members to engage. Honorable.
thank you, Honorable Chair. What concerns me here, we are talking about amendment law that will have a profound change in the way that municipalities will be run. And we are not really aware of what we want to do, because it's going to involve personnel, budget, a lot of very profound things. And the concern that I have, and I want to express it at this time and place, if we're going into a law that's going to change the whole face of South Africa without having access to the regulations that is going to regulate, the legislation afterwards is going to be a very, very serious and even a dangerous thing. For example, the reason why I'm saying today, taking, for example, the MFA and the Systems Act, I think very, very good legislation, nothing wrong. But the regulation that is that has been issued afterwards by National Treasury regarding service delivery and especially supply management makes it almost impossible to run a municipality. At this stage, there are 82 pieces of legislation that makes service delivery impossible. if we don't integrate all those things from a centralized perspective, like the NASA system, I'm not going to elaborate on all the issues because it's too long at this stage. What I would like to ask is sooner or later come forward with the details of this law and what we envisage to achieve. Otherwise, it's going to be a fight into the Constitutional Court. And I think we should avoid that because there are good things that I can see might come out of this legislation. But just a wishy-washy, more or less, what we would see without the regulations, what we will implement, that the law, that is imperative for the government. Otherwise, we are not going to achieve. Because one of the things that we must really say, when you look at service delivery, there are many things that we find with service delivery. But the bottom line of service delivery is how good are our managers trained, how good is our counselors that we are going to appoint in the next two months. And then we cannot always regulate with laws. And that is not, I don't think that is the idea. But I would like to raise my concern that this process must be very, very transparent so that we can exactly see where are we going, what do we want to achieve, and how we are going to achieve. Because one of the big issues is that the unions, the NetLab, they have not been brought in because the unions say already, you are not going to integrate our pensions. The unions are already saying you are not going to move around the people for the distribution of skills from one place to another. So that we must sort out very, very soon so that we can go in harmony into this process to create better service delivery. Otherwise, I can see really a lot of big fights. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Mathieu.
Maybe firstly, we I want to indicate that we welcome the process. You know, because we've been asking as to where this whole issue is at. But you see, one difficult situation. Now recently, the health section in provinces wanted to take over the health from municipalities. And a situation arose where, because of the difference in salaries, that could not happen. You see, I'm not sure as to how this is going to be managed, you know, and that is why clinics are still with municipalities. They should have been taken over by provinces by now, you see. You know? And that's what I knew happened in, particularly in Gauteng. In Gauteng. Now, my worry there is, how are you going to deal with the different salary packages that are there, you know, in municipalities? Because I know in municipalities people earn far more than what people earn in province and national departments, you see. I mean, the simplest example is just municipal managers. They, at some point, they earn far more than a DG, and even the president of the country. You know, and I'm not sure as to how you're going to deal with that situation when you deal with this legislation. And that's where my worry is, because I observe there that there might be a problem that we'll be faced with. But we welcome that situation, because some of the skills that are seated here at national or provincial level could be assisting at local level, because that's where implementation takes place. You see. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. For now, can you respond on this?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the members for both of those items. I think the first speaker, speaking about the framework legislation, the transparency in the consultation processes, and also the need for the regulations to come as part of the package. Just to say that in terms of our processes, we are not going to deviate from the previous process, which was very, very extensive, involved stakeholders from the length and breadth of the country. And in terms of the consultation schedule and processes, all of that will also be unpacked. So we will not leave any stakeholder behind in this process. And if it also means that in terms of our own timelines, to extend some of those things, we will have to go back to our minister and say, Minister, please, we have to ensure that this happens. The issue of the framework legislation, it is at the level of principle. And I think from the second speaker, you're getting a sense of the complexities involved in this. And as many institutions, as many people in South Africa, that is how many different views there can be on one single matter. Remuneration and conditions of service, for example. How do you achieve that alignment? So for us, it is about reaching that consensus position around the principles of these matters, the scope and extent, the minimum norms and standards that we put in place. The regulations, that is the devil, the detail. And we will have to also have a look at a process where, you know, we have to kind of do things a little bit in parallel here. And our legal teams also then working in parallel to the framework legislation and also looking at the regulations and the possibilities around that. But it's very important that the principles are agreed upon first, and then you go into the regulations. You might find yourself going in one direction and the principles are not agreed upon. So that's a process matter that we will take back and have a look at. I think you've really hit the nail on the head, because part of the single public service and its genesis was around the remuneration and conditions of service. And this goes back to 2002 when some studies were done, and it showed how disparate and how fragmented we are in these matters. You could have 283 municipalities with 283 different remuneration packages and salary and conditions of service. So the single public service seeks to try and find alignment. And underpinning that is equal pay for work of equal value. And to get to that, that is where the complexity is. And I think the notion that, you know, that we promulgate this legislation and the next day everybody is on the same scale, is, I think that is a little bit of a pipe dream. I think what we are seeing in terms of the implementation is something like a 25-year program of trying to align, try and, you know, get these things in sync with each other. So as part of that consultation processes, we have done a costing study to show us exactly in terms of conditions of service, your macro benefits, your micro benefits, your pensions, your medical aid schemes, your JE systems, what is this all telling us, and what is the cost to the state around these things. So all of that work as part of the consultation process will be put on the table, and these are the debates and the deliberations that will need to happen. So thank you very much for that, Chair.
Thank you very much. Is the member satisfied with this explanation? Yeah, I think all what we're going to be critically engaged as Parliament is when the legislation or whatever regulation comes to us. That's one. That's the time in which we'll factor all our things as Parliament. But for now, we wanted to know where are we? Are we moving? Is this thing coming? I think that was the gist of why we wanted the presentation update. Thank you very much for that presentation. We hope...
Maybe let us just clarify one issue, because we know departments, when they come to Parliament, particularly to the NCOP, they want to push us to rush through any piece of legislation, and that's not going to happen. We just want to make sure that... Because if we have to consult with communities, with all stakeholders, as Parliament ourselves... You know, we have to go through that process so that have enough time and make sure that that legislation comes to us in time so that we can do our work properly.
Thank you very much. I think at the level of political commitment, we would have to engage much with the minister for the statement, because indeed the minister must make sure that they understand they are like us, they are members of Parliament, why we want it that way. But I think from the level of detailed techniques, you have done what we expected to know. And then we know we'd want to say, don't miss the time frame, but I know, because there are always national issues that might make it a shift. But if we could stick to time frame, we would beat... Because it's supposed to be passed, is it 2013 or 2014? 2013, somewhere there. This legislation.
Chair, basically what we are looking at is 2012.
2012.
Yeah.
All right.
To introduce it into Parliament.
Into Parliament.
And parliamentary processes, that is not for us.
Yeah.
This is now for Parliament.
It's like Parliament is 2013. As I looked inside, I'm not sure. The benefit?
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask for clarity because I think this is a very imperative time frame that we need to know. What is the government's way forward regarding the municipal elections and the one day's elections for Swedish government in 2014? Is this heading towards that date? Is that still on the agenda, that one day elections for Swedish government? Because I think if there must be alignment, because that will influence definitely the time frame if that is the decision that's going to be taken. I don't know if this meeting can give me most probably a guideline on this, but if yes, please say something.
With due apology, I thought if we could wait for Cocktail Ministry, that question will be much more relevant if they are driving the amendment towards 2014 nitty-gritties. But if there's anyone that can answer it, I'm not stopping. But I thought I know where the answer are. Is there anyone who can clarify? No one. Well, but it's noted. I think let's note it and then there'll be Cocktail come and clarify it on that one. Thank you very much. What is the next presentation? According to the program?
Development workers. Thank you, Chair. With your permission, I omitted to acknowledge the presence of the Director General from our sister department, Palama, as part of the delegation. What I have done, Chair, is hand out, with your permission, the actual, we had a policy summit on the CDWs, and that's all the 3,000-odd CDW representatives at a national conference in November 2009. And you wanted an update, and that would be the latest update in terms of the way forward from that particular summit. So just to, what I've included in the... Sorry about that. I won't go through the detail because, you know, from your early input, the role of DPS and service delivery, I think that's clear-cut, and then the role of the CDWs. I will deal with the achievements and the challenges and the way forward in relation to that. So, by and large, for us, the operational achievements are the master plan and the implementation thereof. If you look at the place card that I have provided, there is a review of the master plan. Cabinet took a decision in March 2009 that the intensive role of CDW should be dealing with the war on poverty in terms of the four areas around food security, around HIV and AIDS, early childhood development, and social cohesion. And therefore, the original master plan is currently being adjusted in line with the new role of the CDWs around the areas of the war on poverty, especially with regards to the whole household profiling. The completion of the national skills audit and research, that has been complete, and that is assisting us with the policy aspects that were the recommendations that came out of the policy summit. We have an extensive capacity building arrangement with ITEC in India. There's the implementation of the benchmark job descriptions for the CDWs, that has been benchmarked, and the salary levels as well, and the supervisory positions and what should those be. The CDWs are also integrally involved with the Know Your Rights and Responsibilities campaign in the justice and social clusters, and the establishment and the functioning. The CDW program, the national task team and the provincial task teams are institutionalized and they're functioning very well. We've also published a number of booklets that I have brought with that are, you know, assisting in terms of the aspect of the grassroots and the case studies of all the innovations that are happening at different levels of the CDW workers, as well as each of the CDWs have also got the master plan, so they know exactly what they are supposed to be doing. The challenges, clearly there is a variance in the implementation of the CDW program in provinces. But we have sorted out where two of the provinces had CDWs in the premier's offices. That has now changed, and they now have devolved them to local government in terms of the original cabinet decision in 2004. Funding also is a challenge, and the funding is also different from province to province, and also how national departments support particular sector departments in relation to the CDW program. The number of CDWs employed per province also differs. It's also on the basis of available funding. There is a compulsory learnership that we have got with UNISA. It's at NQF Level 4, and that has now moved out of new UNISA to the FET colleges. And in order to become a CDW, you must go through the learnership first in order to be capacitated to deal with the role. The clarification of roles and responsibilities, there are some challenges at the national workshop. We had a consultative policy workshop in November. Besides the November 2009, this was now follow-up in terms of the policy with the national task team, and they are raising concerns in relation to challenges around roles and responsibilities in certain areas. The common activities still remain a challenge. The poor cooperation and support by sector departments, the two sector departments that are supporting the program the best are Home Affairs and the Department of Social Welfare in terms of the deployment and the MOAs with those particular departments. But there are certain instances where the deployment then is only to municipalities. So the problem in terms of the sector line departments, there is poor cooperation, and those are the only two that have assisted in terms of the need, especially with the IDs, with regards to social grants and so forth. The guidelines developed have been very useful for the particular CDWs, but unfortunately, they still just remain as guidelines. And hence the challenges now, the policy gaps. We have met with COCSA, and we have thrashed out the issues of the fact that we're at different spheres and that the CDWs, in terms of the original cabinet decision, had had two decisions. The one is that the CDWs will be public servants, and public servants are only appointed, you know, via the Public Service Act, but they will be deployed at a local level, and they will be housed at the department of then, it was then local government, which is the Department of Cooperative Governance. So clearly what we're trying to reconcile with the COG or COCTA is how do we get a legal, regulatory, and policy framework that assists throughout the three spheres in relation to the role of CDWs, because their greatest obligation is around driving, access to services and their close relationship, to citizens. So that for us is the achievement. Just to share with you the numbers at this particular point in time, there are 3,909 wards, and there are 950 wards that do not have CDWs. Our current number by the December workshop that we had with the National Task Team, we have got 3,395 CDWs. That are located with the Department of Local Government, and they are deployed either to municipalities, Home Affairs, or to SASA. Just to conclude in relation to the recommendation from ourselves and COCTA at the end in relation to the challenges that we have, the recommendation is to continue to plan for the community workers within our respective legal mandates until those legal mandates change. And I think the earlier presentation would then be a guideline for us in the ultimate, event that we have the piece of legislation, then we can adjust in relation to our respective mandates. But we have to develop the necessary and respective legal frameworks for our respective mandates so that we can institutionalize the community development workers and also provide the developmental support. And Palama Assistant Department would also share in terms of the role that they are playing with regard to the training of CDWs as well. So the you would see the terminology community worker. We have come up with draft regulations which came out of the policy conference. One of the things that the community development workers were saying, there are numerous community workers that are volunteers, especially in the health sector. In fact, the number that was shared with us was somewhere in the vicinity of 65,000 care workers on a voluntary basis. And if there was a regulatory framework in terms of job creation, we could get quite a number of community workers that could then have different categories, of working in different sectors, but they are direct community workers. So there are a number of inputs that have come from the community development workers themselves in relation to the institutionalizing of different categories of community workers servicing different sectors according to the social needs of those particular sectors in relation to the communities that they are supposed to be servicing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that. Can we engage on that one? If there's any comments, or the Honorable Vera first.
Honorable Chair, my experience with CVDWs was that the biggest problem is the control of the CDWs out of the Premier's office. Because if you wanted to do service delivery, you must decentralize to people where they are. You must incapacitate the municipalities so that they can run it and they can share the services available. But at this stage, it is, I agree, it's not a sound situation because the alignment of social services and medical services through districts, municipalities, and agencies is not working, can never work. So give the responsibility to the people who are managing the grounds, have a good liaison line from the parent departments, and that can work. Then the training is also a problem, and then unfortunately, some of the CDWs thought that they were there to become future board councillors, like playing politics in spaces and not serving the communities. I don't have a problem with the CDW concept, but the command and control and the alignment with departments and the responsible municipalities on the ground level who are responsible for communities, that is where the problem lies. We should not restructure it. We should rather restructure the system and get it back to where it needs to be and get the control on the ground where the people are working. Thank you, sir.
Any other Honorable Bloom?
Thank you very much. On challenges, I see that there's only two departments that is really cooperating with you. What is the reason? It is mentioned here, and can you please name
I think maybe if this process can move faster, because you see the problem we see on the ground is that these people do not have tools of trade on the ground. I mean, in my own constituency, sometimes I have to assist them, which is a problem, you see? Because they don't have the resources to do their work. Municipalities are also not assisting them, which is a problem. And until such time that their work, they have proper guidelines, departments or whoever is responsible for them, because there's also this turf as to whether they belong to local government or they belong to this particular department. You see, there are also those problems. And if those problems can be sorted out, we think they can do a better work. But they can't do their job precisely because they don't, you know, there's nobody, as my colleague has indicated, who is monitoring them, who is looking after what they're supposed to be doing, and all those things. You see? And that's what we see, we experience on the ground, you see? Particularly when we do constituency work. Sometimes we think they're useless. Sometimes. And sometimes they're useful because there are a lot of good work that they do. But precisely, they are also not properly guided to do their work. And I think if this process can move faster, so that they can give a better service to those communities, the better for us all. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Just to add few, to get clarity questions. I see three provinces. They are with
out because they have very few CDWs. Northwest and KZN and Western Cape. What do we have as a plan to make sure that they are appointed? Precisely because there is a call for job creation. I think the president would want to know the contribution of each department towards job creation. I think these are some of the areas that you could tap into to assist that 5 million in what, in 10 years, whatever. If there is a plan, maybe one could know, could be told. But also, why do we have so many wars without CDW in those provinces? The other issue is that now we are going to municipal elections. Do we have a plan? Because the wards will increase to 4,277, if I'm not wrong. From 3,000, we will have 4,277. In line with the appointment of CDW, is there a plan to confront that? I think that is the last one is this. Why do we have some department not cooperating? And only issue is only Home Affairs and Social Services. These others are not cooperating, including the owners, COCTA. Why? Maybe these are some of the issues that we need to note for oversight.
Honorable Chair, you are so right. You know, when I was the mayor of the Overstrand, we had the Stoesong Center, and we really spent a lot of money to get the departments in there, like Home Affairs, to help to come and help people with IDs, to get them voter registrations and all those things. And it's almost impossible to move those departments to come and do service delivery. They just don't come to the table. We give them everything. They must just come, and they don't come. But social services, well services, because they have the clinics. In the Western Cape, the clinics are not part of the municipalities. They are part of the province. We support them at the municipal level. But really, I cannot more emphasize that somebody must take up the department and say, now you go to the ground, and you have the facilities, just go there. But when they come to municipality, and there are two song centers where they want to have this institutions, they come with money, they don't have money, they don't have furniture, they don't have telephones, they don't have cell phones. It's just I don't have departments. That is the problem.
Thank you very much for the questions as well as very valuable comments from the House. Just to indicate to you that the challenge that had been raised is the absence of the policy framework, and a number of the issues that have been raised will be addressed within the policy framework. But what we did see, in the absence of regulations, it becomes difficult to come up with the norms and standards and also the minimum requirements and what should constitute a CDW. And therefore, the draft regulations is what gives rise to the policy. One of the questions that the Honourable Member was asking was about the guidelines. Legally, there has to be enabling legislation, and the enabling legislation gives rise to the policy, and the policy gives rise either to a determination or to a directive that gives rise to either a guideline or a handbook or a Z card or eventually the implementation tools. Now, clearly, in the incubation period of the actual CDWs, there was a lot of exploratory work that was being done initially. Now, the time is ripe from the research to actually go into a policy terrain and have the regulations that will deal with the issues of the norms and standards, because a lot of it was left up to chance in relation to the fact that if you look at the cabinet decision then, it was the fact that these CDWs had to be a special kind of public servant, number one, and number two, that they had to be located at the then local government. And the understanding was there will be an MOU signed between a municipality that required the service and that local government department. Now, clearly, if the municipality didn't have a need, then they wouldn't request it, and then there would not be an MOU. And this is where you get the situation where you're not getting an equitable norm in relation to the distribution of CDWs, because the request is coming from the municipality to the Department of Local Government. And I hope COFTA could assist, because that is their purview in relation to managing that MOU. Now, with regards to sector departments, what we realize is, for argument's sake, education will have jobs that are overlapping with regards to what we call a CDW, but they've got a formal job. So in education, you'll get people that are appointed to deal with school governing bodies, to deal with school nutrition, to deal with social cohesion, to deal with all aspects of vegetable gardens at schools, to deal with the truancy in terms of dealing with the social relationship between communities and learners. So you'd expect a CDW to be doing that in a different sector for different parallel outcomes. But therefore, you wouldn't get a request from education saying, we specifically need CDWs, because they've already defined work that covers that particular purview. Now, for us, the policy framework as well as the regulations will start setting norms and standards and allow those different sectors then to call those community development workers, like the key workers I raised, the 65,000 that are voluntary workers. How do you bring them formally in, and they will do the work for the health sector specific to community development? So there would be community development workers, but specific to, to the health sector. So for us, the panacea, the way we see it at this point in time, and therefore the Honourable Member is correct, that we have to be fast-tracking the aspect of the policy framework in order to regulate departments to do those things, and therefore it's not left up to chance. Because the issue of legislating, I mean, the one issue that the other Honourable Member raised in relation to Home Affairs utilizing the Tusong Service Center, just in terms of the Tusong Service Centers, we've realized that there's certain transactional functions as well as pro-poor functions that you can't leave it up to chance. A Tusong Service Center eventually must be offering exactly the same departmental sector services. That is not a choice whether Home Affairs goes there or not. So the similar sort of sentiment for us needs to be included in the CDWs, but the minute you got norms and standards, you would then start seeing in terms of the distribution with regards to what is in wards, which COCTA would be managing, you'd start getting at least some sort of picture where there's a uniform distribution in relation to the CDWs. But if you look at the presentation as well, one of the issues that came up from the Cabinet decision in 2009 is how can we have CDWs also located at Tusong Service Centres, because those are the centres where citizens are accessing transactional services, and therefore the policy framework must indicate where must they be located and all the definition of what they need to be doing. In relation to the aspects of their recruitment, the only compulsory aspect with regard to their recruitment at this point in time is around the learnership that they have to undergo for 1 year. It's 6 months theoretical training and 6 months practical training. But with the policy framework, we're going to have to legislate, because the challenges that have come up is that you also need a supervisory layer. So currently they're at a salary level 6 within the public service, but there's a disparity in that some people have got master's degrees, some people don't even have matric. So it's inequitable in terms of the starting point with regards to the aspects of the recruitment criteria. So the norming and the standards would actually assist with regard to what is the minimum requirement and also what is the core competencies that somebody should be having in order to become a CDW. DW. Thank you.
I think the main thing is to speed up this policy matter, precisely because many things may not be resolved. It's not only in education, but there is also a clash between CDW and counselors, ward counselors in particular. So I think the sooner we deal with the policy issues, I think other matters will be solved. Welcome, Chief Whip, I mean Whip of the committee. Honorable Rui, we welcome. Thank you very much. Can you go to other aspects?
Thank you, Chief. The next update that you were requesting was around the implementation of the Batupele principle. And what I have included in the presentation, it was more for the benefit of new members, is around the history of the actual Batupele policy. But what I'd be sharing with you is the where we are at in relation to the Batupele impact assessment. Just to share with you before I get to that, I think which would be of interest to the House is there has been training around the Batupele change management engagement. We have trained across the three spheres of government, notwithstanding the fact that our mandate isn't yet around the purview of local government, but in the absence of a Batupele principle legislated within local government, we have responded to those particular requests. Those are the national departments and the provincial departments in terms of the Batupele change management engagement. At local government level, we have trained 222 persons within the municipalities that are the change agent for Batupele. The breakdown at local government level for us are 8 in terms of 3 local municipalities, 4 district municipalities, and 1 metro. And our target 4, 11, 12 are 3 departments, each at a provincial, at a national level, because it's quite a large cohort that we train in at any one time around the efficacy of the actual change management program. But for the Department of Cooperative Governance, they are the ones that are dealing directly with municipalities going forward in the new year, because as I've indicated, DPSA has been dealing directly with municipalities, notwithstanding the fact that we haven't had a direct legal cord to the actual aspects of Batupele. So the aspect is how Department of Cooperative Governance then institutionalizes legally the Batupele principles and ensures that those are then institutionalized at a local government. Just to share with you, those are the municipalities where we have trained the actual Batupele agents that are designated by their particular municipalities. Those are the targeted ones for this particular financial year, the past one. But by and large, these are the ones that we are dealing with in terms of our flagship programs. And now I'll get on to the aspect of the impact assessment. Just in terms of the refocus for us, the refocus for the impact assessment, it's more about looking at integrated service delivery but using Batupele as a vehicle. What we have done is we've allocated the separate of the 8 Batupele principles, we've allocated that to each of the provinces, within Mpumalanga being allocated as the 9th province dealing with 4 of the 8 principles. Now, we've allocated dedicated monthly themes in line with government's priorities, because government's priorities in terms of the outcomes that was introduced last year, and we're also in the process of introducing the excellence awards that will come out from the impact assessments insofar as we have seen how public servants have implemented the principles of Batupele. The support issues for us, it's the identification of the key service delivery issues, the strengthening and the development of appropriate structures, strategies that have been put in place to inform and direct implementation through the advocacy and the education, the monitoring and evaluation measures, and the reporting and accountability. Now, what we've done in the public service, which was just a month ago, we have designed what we call an organizational readiness assessment tool, where each department will then assess itself against all the deliverables that it's supposed to be delivering on, with a great emphasis around the aspect of the Batopele principles. And clearly they have to report against those. Now, the check-in is, in terms of visas and site visits, the strategy of the minister is that for the visits that are in the Batopele impact assessment is that he, together with the relevant minister who is responsible for that particular outcome, together with the premier of that relevant province and the relevant MEC for that sector department that he is going to, should be collaborating with the mayors and councillors in that particular locality, but also dealing with unannounced site visits to the service delivery points where we are measuring those particular principles, where we've got to meet with public servants and citizens and listen to their challenges and solutions. The objective of these particular site visits is to seek to improve service delivery by identifying the areas of deficiencies in delivering the services to our citizens in order to reduce service delivery protests, but also to demonstrate not only the seriousness with which service delivery is viewed. All this from our particular strategy is together with the Minister of Cooperative Governance as well, especially where we would be going into municipal spatial areas where the particular services are being delivered under the purview of this particular MEC or the Minister. Also the visibility of government to support public service in improving the service delivery by focusing on all the identified sectors per theme, and this is linked to the specific Batopele principle per province. Now, as I've indicated, the monitoring and evaluation will be done together with the sector department and the line department using the actual organizational readiness assessment tool as a diagnostic tool that actually is specific for the sector. And we're measuring all the aspects of access, value for money, and the principles, the Batopele principles for those particular sectors. Now, for us, this is how we've divided the themes, because according to the outcomes-based aspects, the education, safety and security, human rights, health, and clearly those are the different sectors that we are targeting. Those are the provinces that we are targeting together with the relevant ministers in terms of the site visit. Rural, urban and community development, youth development, education sector, women emancipation, culture and heritage, I see we've got the health sector twice, environment, rights of women. Now, the different provinces have been allocated different principles. Eastern Cape, what we'd be measuring for all the different departments that we'd be going to in the Eastern Cape are service standards. For the Free State, it's openness and transparency. For Gauteng, it's value for money. For KwaZulu-Natal, it's information. For Limpopo, it's courtesy. Northern Cape, accessibility. Western Cape, redress. North-West, consultation. And in Mpumalanga, we'd be measuring all the particular principles. So the whole intention is that a province must be given a year to incubate and really spend all its energy horizontally on a particular Batopele principle. And once we are satisfied that that is institutionalized, then there is a rotation in relation to them ensuring that they covered over a period of 8 years all the eight principles to try and get an institutionalization of the impact of the whole aspect of the Batopele principles. That for us is the strategy that is in place. But for us, the collaborative efforts with the launch of the anti-corruption unit, there is an aspect of the ethics and integrity framework. What they will be doing is the institutionalization of the Batopele principles through the code of ethics, and that would assist in relation to ensuring the behavioral aspect of public service, which at the moment that has been the greatest challenge. The other challenge for us is the compliance aspects with regards to the Batopele principles. What we've engaged the Auditor General with is ensuring that the reporting mechanisms with regards to the Batopele implementation need also to be investigated around the performance issues in line departments. The collaboration with the local government on service delivery challenges, the importance for us is the integrated services to citizens within a joint-up strategy. The joint-up strategy for us is around the Tucson service centers and how as frontline service delivery points like Tucson service centers, we ensure that the aspect of the Batopele impact assessment is felt. But the communication with stakeholders, that for us has also been a challenge. And the challenge has been addressed under the community development workers. We have now introduced a draft policy on public participation, but with specific reference to how do we have a complaints management system so that citizens have a formal way in which they can raise complaints against public servants who are not delivering in the expected way. And that if you go to the DPSA website, you will see the draft consultative document on the complaints management strategy and how we would be engaging with citizens in terms of assisting with keeping public servants accountable with regards to delivery. But for us, as we've indicated, where no legal mandate exists for us to come up with policies in the sphere of municipalities, Department of Cooperative Governance, we have engaged with them in terms of ensuring that the Batopele policy and legal framework has been replicated at the local sphere of government, because that is where the challenge is, in that service delivery protests are by and large in the local sphere, and how do we keep public servants accountable for delivery when the policy within the national MPSA is not applicable through the legal frameworks. So the only way is to work through the Department of Cooperative Governance for them to ensure that there's accountability by public, at least workers at the municipal sphere of government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There we are. Honorable Bloom.
Thank you very much, Chairman. You know, I think that we are wasting taxpayers' money by sending this document and briefing us on Batopele. You know, the word Batopele is something very, very special. But I can tell you, Jefferson, and the department here, that I think it's from there to west when it comes to delivery of this Batopele. I see that in your document you are talking about the health. You go to a hospital or a clinic. I am saying that, you know, the way in which people are being treated there in the hospital by nurses, I'm not saying all nurses, I'm saying if this is a policy or a plan, then these things must not be on paper alone. It must be implemented. You go to a police station, you know, some of these people think that they are doing you a favor to do that thing, to give service to the people. I can go on and on. You know, when you want to see a police, you go to banks, and I'm saying all the banks, you will see that there is Batopele. These people treat you with the respect that you deserve. Now, public servants must do the same. And I can tell you, you know, Comrade Nadia, we can be proud of one thing, at least. In the Department of Correctional Services, we have instilled that thing, not 100%, but at least 80%, that when we got there, it was tough. But at least there is that thing of Batopele. But in this other department, especially I'm talking about hospitals, when it comes to nurses, they don't care. And I am saying, you know, it is black people who complain.
many of the not white people, because hospital in my area, Boitumelo, is the only hospital. There's no more Poor Tracker Hospital and one. People are all in one hospital. I'm saying, I am visiting hospitals, and I came here in my constituency. People are complaining about the treatment that people are to pay. Men's ears. That is what I would say.
You know, this issue around Batupele has long been there. And each time the department will tell us we are there, we don't see those things happening. Because I must tell you, from the area I come from, you're better treated in a municipal clinic than in a hospital. Now, that's where you see Batupele. Because most people want to go to a municipal clinic than the other clinics we have, because they're better treated there. That's why. Now, I'm not sure, as when you say people have been trained, this is what is happening, and things are not moving. Things are actually going backwards. And across departments, that is what is happening. I'm not sure what is it that the department is doing. Maybe the department is untraining people now. Maybe that's what the department is doing. You're thinking you're doing something good, but you're doing something negative. And this is what we experience on a daily basis. Fortunately, we live within those communities. I don't stay in a suburb. I stay in a township. And that's what people are experiencing on a daily basis. I'm not sure as to how long is it going to take you to implement what you're saying. Because when I was still in Gauteng in the legislature, that's what we were told always. This is where the department is. You know, I've spent almost 10 years in the legislature. And we're told one thing. Nothing has improved. I'm almost 2 years here. The same things, issues have been repeated here. Maybe, Chair, you're right. We must go and do some oversight over this particular department and see what is happening within the department. Possibly, the problem is within the department itself. Maybe you get the same treatment as Member Bloom is saying. Maybe within the department, there might not be a Batupele there. And if there's no Batupele in the department itself, how would you train other people? I mean, that's the question I'm asking, Chair. I'm just saying, if you compare hospitals with municipal clinics, there's a huge difference. And that is why I'm saying, from where I come from in Gauteng, people prefer to go to clinics than provincial clinics or hospitals, precisely because of the issues you're raising here. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure whether the department will be able to respond. I think this thing goes beyond. It goes beyond. It needs all departments. I don't know how we can engage all departments. I don't know. There's no what to do. In fact, it's about morale. It's bad on the ground by our own government. I'm not sure. Maybe we need to put our heads together and declare it as part of corruption. Corruption behavior. I'm not sure. It's bad, especially at the hospital. When you are supposed to take a person who's ill to hospital, even you as a member of parliament, you get headache. You don't even know whether you must say, hey, I'm an MP, why do you do this thing? you don't know what should you say, because sometimes it's embarrassing. Maybe other Honorable Bloom, we must make this a national endeavor to assist the department. So living it like this is too complex. It's about attitudes, isn't it? Yeah, to fight the attitudes, to change the attitude, I'm not sure, but something must be done. Honorable Belfast.
Honorable Chair, you know, one of the very interesting things that we are talking about is the question of service delivery. And that there is a lot of reason why, there are a lot of reasons why we have some service delivery problems. But it's interesting what we are saying now. I'm listening to our colleagues saying that people on ground level prefer in Gauteng to go to the clinic than to the hospital. And if you look at service delivery, and when you look at this, that watch the television in the evening where we have problems, I say with my experience, 70% of service delivery problems are created by provinces and national competencies that not exercise their functions and not the municipalities. Because health services is not a municipal function. Have a look in the constitution. Schools, education, all those things, national roads, potholes on the open, that's not municipal functions, it's national competencies. But it's very easy for the press to come and make the municipality the culprit of everything that's wrong. So if we cannot get all people together, and I don't say that they are no good, that municipalities are good. I think we have seen that our oversight, how municipalities are looking what's going on there, I admit, in the first place. But this is it. The only thing that we should do is not only oversight. We must get a total mind shift regarding service delivery in our country. And the people will motivate to do anything. But the fact is that there's not one single solution. It's a state of mind that we'll have to change for all our departments to do better service delivery for our people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, you want to respond? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think the presentation that we'll have on Palama will touch on some of those things, and I would really beg the members just to hold back so that, you know, when we diagnose the whole program as it relates to training, let's discuss it in totality. Thank you.
No, Chair, the point I wanted to make is a broader point. It's a general point, basically. I think in the context of the discussion and the debate, one point that should not be lost is that the issue of the culture to serve is a social consciousness issue. And therefore, perhaps what we should also begin to look at from this point onwards is also the issue that you just raised, Chair, perhaps, you know, expanding it. You know, we need to have a broader discussion, a broader debate, not as just the Department of Public Service and Administration, so that we begin to take a shift away from looking at the issue of Batopile as just purely and narrowly an administrative matter. So, for instance, I think if we are to develop a culture to serve in South Africa, key critical questions would be, what are the input factors that you require in order to achieve that? For instance, Professor Ye will also take us through in terms of training interventions, which is fine, and some of the interventions that we have alluded to. But you do need to have a broader societal effort to be able to deal with the question of turning the situation around, because it's more to do with the social culture that somehow has developed. You know, I have to provide a service to you, but I just simply do not care, because as long as I'm paid the salary, it's fine. You know, things like that. And I think that's a broader societal issue that we should begin to look at. So I'm throwing this point as a general point, but also expanding, Chair, on the point that you made, that we
outcome one, which is quality public education, and outcome two, which is the provisioning of basic health to all citizens. For each of these two departments, the priority for that cohort of employees in the health sector and in the education sector is Batopile has been identified as one of the key things that has to be inculcated within those sectors, and that is in those particular ministers' performance agreement with the president. And clearly it's been identified, and it's been identified as something that needs to be addressed in order to address service delivery. But I think as government we also have to give praise where praise is due. I mean, the amount of positive coverage that Home Affairs has got with regards to its turnaround, as well as the institutionalization of Batopile in our Home Affairs offices. For most of us that have gone to Home Affairs in the past 12 months, I think we've seen the difference between a Home Affairs before and a Home Affairs afterwards. So there are success cases, and we have to learn from those success cases as to how did Home Affairs do it, and how can we replicate the strategy of Home Affairs, you know, to ensure that the officials that are servicing the public basically know exactly what their obligation is as servants of the public. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think we know that, but let's agree that, yeah, this is a national challenge. I think it's for all of us, not only, according to me, not only the administration. That's why I'm calling for engagement. I think even at parliament level, there must be engagement on this issue, particularly as we go to constituency offices, as we do our this visit. There must be a way in which we get redress on this matter. You know, it's, one doesn't know, you go to the hospital, people are not served, you phone the department does not respond according to what to be, because you want to bimba. You don't know what to do, you get frustrated, you are looked at as a leader. I think the hands one would get, if we could get that engagement, as you said, would get a way, you know, a way of how do we, when you are confronted with that situation, what do we do? Who do you contact? You contact the premier. Premiers are so busy that at that spot you even get tired, you leave. You know? I think, to me, this engagement is important. But also, to take the very example of Home Affairs is now a darling of everyone because they have turned around the situation. You know, I never thought that one day you can get an INT in 2 weeks when you had to wait for a year or so. Nowadays, 2 weeks, they tell you through an SMS, I don't know how they do it, that your ID is ready. So we need to learn, maybe. And maybe apply it across the department where it's necessary. I think less for now, rest this matter in the understanding that both of us, the department and the committee, if we can have an engagement and identify who can be key on the implementation of this. If we could rest on that one. While we welcome Palama's answers on some of the issues, but broadly I think we need a serious engagement on this one. Thank you very much. Maybe we can go to the next aspect.
Yeah.
Committee. I don't know who is that. Is it Palama? By Sege.
Oh, Palama man.
Honorable members of the Select Committee, members from other departments, I think it's really a great pleasure to share with you an update of what Palama is doing. I must say, I'm saying it is a pleasure because it affords one an opportunity actually to share as to what Palama is doing. And one wonders, now the frustration is I am not sure in terms of how far was this committee briefed in terms of understanding what Palama is and what Palama is doing. Because I'm tempted to say, from the onset, the way the presentation was structured, I started pondering upon a question that whether do we understand that Palama is a separate Schedule 1 department, it's like a department of training. But I'm also saying that the frustration is out of an indictment that came out of the Batopili principles. And I'm saying an indictment because really, that presentation is a window, or it gives us a window into actually how the state of the public service training is. And I must say, we have to acknowledge from the onset that state of training leaves much to be desired. And that's by way of opening. But also, Chair, I'm also mindful of the opening remarks you made in terms of that we must shorten the presentation. And as I'm saying, I'm trying to juxtapose that with the frustration as to how far does the committee know about this particular organization. However, I will endeavor to try and clarify what the expectations are. There was, of course, a miscommunication in the beginning because the first correspondence that we got was that the presentation was about how does Palama support the Batopili principles. But it was only late last night that it was clarified that the presentation is actually about the update on Palama. And early this morning we managed to redo the presentation. And this is the presentation that I'm going to give you. I think what I said, it was also to try and give you the what Palama is. We will first look at the problem statement because I think that is very essential. And we will also just give snapshots of some of the pronouncements by the executives on Palama and look at what the strategic framework do we have currently towards the repositioning of Palama, and as an endeavor to address some of the questions and the frustrations that were actually outlined here by honorable members. What those key elements of the strategic framework to reposition Palama are, and the process map towards the cabinet approval, obviously, and give a concluding remark. Honorable member, obviously, it is common knowledge that South Africa is working towards a developmental state. And I think this is important because it then gives us the framework from which that particular training has to be relevant and what it should inform. And obviously, we know that being a developmental state requires the state to be able to lead in the strategic orientation of a particular country. Now, for the state to lead, we know that the technical and organizational capacity of that particular state is key. Therefore, training or capacity building, it's important to enable a state to translate its broad objectives into projects and programs that are implementable. And to do that, we require proper training at all levels. Leadership should be trained across the board at all levels. The current public servants should be reoriented, and those that are coming into the public service should be inducted so that we can inculcate new doctrines, ethos, cultures, and practices. Obviously, the continuous acquisition of new skilled personnel is important. Now, let me start by looking at the mandate of Palama and try and look at the problem statement and which talks to the which characterized the earlier discussion that we had. That Palama, as a Schedule I department of government, has its mandate. Its mandate is to improve the capacity for service delivery and implementation of government initiatives through training. And as I said earlier on, that the discussion is an indictment on this particular mandate. Where does the problem lie? We have an institution, and we have to be brutally frank with ourselves, that and what I'm going to talk to is the current business model of how Palama is structured. And it simply says from the beginning that today, training remains uncoordinated, incoherent, and largely outsourced. The current business model is an outsourced model, where those service providers that conduct the model, some of them have never even worked for the public service. And they come in, they don't understand how government works, but obviously, if I can make money out of it, so why bother? And I think this is the brutal reality that we need to confront. Those providers that this service is outsourced to are both private and public providers. You have training academies. You have individual contractors. And let me talk of these institutions of the training academies. The model is structured in such a way that, you know, if a department needs training, it goes through Palama, who, for an example, go to the University of Pretoria and get facilitators from the University of Pretoria at a markup of about 40%, without any value addition, and then they whoever comes out of that university will come and present the course. Now, the question the departments ask themselves: why must I go through Palama? Why, if I can go directly to the university? So the question is: our training remains uncoordinated; it is not focused. Secondly, this training, which does not make an impact. It's actually the coverage remains inadequate. The training covers about 38,000 of the 1.5 million public servants. The training that we do and the money that we spend of training, actually there is no impact assessment whether our training is relevant or it makes difference. And I think the earlier or discussion on our the state of our of the attitude of our people in hospitals speaks to that particular one, that there must be a lot of training and money that was spent on training, but obviously there's no return on investment. And the training that we have narrowly focuses on junior, middle, and senior managers. And those that are in administration who give support and who are in the front line of service delivery are not covered. And those comprise about 70% of members of the public service. Much as the executive, that our training actually is meant for the executive, not all the executive is covered. Obviously, it's a discretion, and some of the people are not even interested. The current dispensation, as it is, does not actually include local government. Local government training is neglected. And the relevance and responsiveness of training is insufficient. And the model that we have currently is too expensive because it's a model that is anchored around consultants. Now, that's my way of defining, in short, the problem statement of the public service training. Of course, acknowledging the importance of public service training, I'm going to refer to some of the pronouncement made by the executive. The Honorable State President of the Republic in his State of the Nation address in 2009, speaks of, and I quote, working with the people and supported by our public servants, we will build a developmental state to improve the public services. And we will ensure courteous and efficient service from the front counter staff. And he says our commitment to fight corruption in the public. Those are some of the things that we think should inform us as we build the developmental state, which I started from the beginning that it is quite important. But the commitment from the Minister of Public Service in his 2010 budget vote, he says, we are placing Palama at the level where the agency ought to be a preparatory school for entry into the public service. Incubate them through in-service development intervention. Of course, for Palama to do what we call for, the agency itself should be transformed. Now, this actually, it's at the core of this presentation. But in elaborating what the Minister of Public Service says to the transformation, he posed certain key challenges to Palama. And those challenges, I would like to share them with the committee. He says, what defines and distinguishes the academy from just being a broker of training services? Secondly, he says, what defines the state of government training academy? He also says, what is the most appropriate institutional form for Palama? How can the existing public service capacity be used to strengthen Palama's capacity? And what is Palama's strategic thrust? And what is Palama's niche area? What is the preferred and most feasible financial model? If key programs are made compulsory, would Palama cope with the demand? Should Palama remain focused on leadership and management? What is Palama's role vis-a-vis other state-funded training units, for example, like provincial academies? Now, those are the challenges that he posed as we embark on the journey of making this particular institution relevant and addressing to those questions that were raised by the members. Now, in addressing all these things, we went through a journey that I'm not going to bore the members with the details, which I think they would have been very important. But we had our first contact session as a collective in a place called Misty Hills, where we started this journey of developing a framework that would reposition this institution to address the frustrations that were raised. In that particular one, the first most important one is to look at the proposed strategic thrust. And you members will obviously acknowledge that you are talking of the proposed, because the final framework will be a decision of cabinet. Suffice to say, if members can recall, that in 2005, the then cabinet asked the Minister of Public Service and Administration as to whether somebody by then had the capacity to render and deliver to capacitate the public servants. And in response to that, the minister appointed what was called the Ministerial Committee, which made an investigation. And the composition of that Ministerial Committee comprised of a number of stakeholders, including international public servants like Professor Chandra from India. It was chaired by Vincent Mapai from Brewer. And we had members across all the spectrum, I think also members of Parliament. Their recommendations were tabled before Parliament. And that led to the migration from the then Samdi into the now Palama. But the crux of it was a deviation in creating this Palama. It deviated from the recommendations made by cabinet. Hence the journey we're on. It is a journey of repositioning and further transforming Palama to align it with cabinet decision, taking into account changes in the environment that have happened. And this strategic thrust that at Missy Hills we came upon was, number one, to acknowledge that the thrust is to train and develop public servants across all three spheres of government and related organs of state in administrative, management, and leadership competencies. Secondly, we said we need to professionalize the public service through inculcating value systems, ethos, and service culture that supports the implementation of the government's developmental agenda. Thirdly, the thrust is to lead the provision of high-quality training and development programs through on-board capacity and strategic partnerships. Now, obviously, it is a very ambitious program that we embark on, but it's doable. And we said, what are those goals, proposed goals, for us to realize the strategy? We said, number one, that our curricula should be informed by the developmental needs of the state related to the government's strategic framework. Secondly, there must be relevant and high quality public sector training and development. And obviously, for Palama to do that, it needs a high performance organization. Subsequent to that, after a consultative process, we also had another session in the SEDI where we looked at the real vision and mission of our organization, that yes, indeed, this institution should be fully funded and resourced. It should be a public service provider of choice. There should be a residential institutional base operating nationally with provisional satellites. It must provide a high-quality relevant training, leads in training, policy development and coordination, and mold the South African public service into a mode of thinking and doing things. You know the McDonald's story, that when you go to a McDonald's in Cape Town or in Thailand or in the U.S., you have been to a McDonald's. But when you go to the Department of Agriculture in the Western Cape and you go to the Department of Housing in Limpopo, it's like day and night. And we want to say, with common ethos and value system, it should be that like that McDonald's story, that you have been to a government service in the Republic of South Africa. And that those are the ethos and values that we think we should inculcate. And that talks to the attitude of the people. It talks to the mental element. It talks to those Matupili principles that we refer to. And then there is, in the study, we said, fine, these are missions and visions, objectives that the objectives of this organization. We said we should develop officials across the public sector who are passionate, trained to perform, and committed to improving service delivery and development. Palama graduates should exhibit values, ethos, and culture of public service as a government corporate identity. In service professional skills development supported by research, intelligence, and advice for individuals and organizations. The Minister of Public Service and Administration has on numerous occasions spoken and gave us a guideline in terms of the attributes that she thinks should be calculated for us to have a public servant. And the details of what has happened in that regard, but because of time, I will just mention those attributes. The first one is referred to, and these are the things that inform this framework as we move forward, is breaking new ground. A public servant that is innovative, not shying away from coming up with new ideas, who inspires success and self-motivated and ready to motivate others. A public servant who is able to raise the standard and that is capable of giving his or her best regardless of whether he or she is in the front office or at the back office or at the management level. That particular public service should believe that nothing is impossible and obviously come up with strategies that will make, that will turn those situations around. It is a public servant that is able to take collective responsibility and is a team player who is on board and owning service delivery processes, making a difference in people's lives, understands that the public service has to serve a larger population, and that this population has expectations that should always be considered when one is doing his work. An internationalist approach is this public servant is an active agent in implementing the public service agenda, of course, in fulfilling the South African mandate in terms of the continent and the world at large. Now, what is it that we would do on this broader repositioning of this institution? The process map is, number one, the repositioning of Palama the consultations on the draft framework are taking place, and we hope that they will be concluded by May this year. The framework and the draft, with all the benchmarks, the draft has already been developed. It has been given to the minister, but the consultation with other relevant stakeholders, so that we are sure that we are on course. And then that framework, the minister will bring it to Parliament and other departments. We also, number two, look at reviewed institutional, the review of the institution, the funding and the governance model. We envisage that by the 31st of July, it should be approved by Cabinet, so that we are in line with the MTF. Thirdly, the ministerial approval on the compulsory and targeted programs by 31st of March 2012, and the revised funding model, where Treasury will play a profound role, by 31st March 2012. Now, I must say that on all these activities that we have been going through this process, we have brought people from Treasury on board. We have invited sister departments like DPSA on board, Public Service Commission, and many role players, so that they can make inputs during the transformation model in this regard. In conclusion, Chair, we envisage that by 2014, all public servants should be trained under an integrated public service model framework, receiving targeted mandatory training in specified fields, receiving a minimum of 5 days training per annum, and serving a minimum of 5 days at service delivery points of government per annum, and implementing a revolving door policy that is partnership and experience sharing with academia and the private sector, and where we are able to second officials to those institutions and vice versa. But I'm saying, as the last point, is that while this broader framework is being developed, and there is also the way government has decided to do business, the outcomes approach. And in realizing that, much as we are looking at the broader transformation and the further transformation in the bigger model, the business of government must continue. That has actually made it imperative for us to restructure the organization internally with the approval of the minister, so that we are positioned, not the way the organization has been, as I have said earlier on, in the outsource model, but where we focus on leadership, on the technical skills management and the administration, giving the technical support in terms of research and development for us to be able to realize and serve the outcomes of government. Can I take a pause here, Honorable Chair?
Thank you very much. Can we come on, Louis?
You see, if I was, if this was a church gathering, Chair, I would have then started my talk with a song that says "Evangeli elakudala." You know, you know, Chair, I sat here since I came. I even remembered. Oh, by the way, I've been around these precincts for a while myself, when I was listening, since Mr. Kego was the chairperson of the Public Service Administration Committee, and the current minister, and many others. You know, in reality, you know, in general, I'm not a very negative person, but in reality, I think the most slow transformation department is Public Service and Administration. With the change of ministers, the change of chairpersons, it's the more of the same things that we talk about that are on plan. But be that as it may, Chair, the presentation was hoping to to help us to understand the better linkages and the role Parliament would play in implementing Batopil and institutionalizing it. I'm not too sure, Chair. Perhaps I must just ask a question. Practically, what would Palima do? It is, I heard he talked about the objectives and one or two activities that they would undertake in 2012, and 2011, 2012, and 2014. But are they offering, because it sounded like a totally separate presentation of an institution somewhere that you know, if someone came in, he would never thought that it's a government department. Someone would have thought, no, it's some certain professors that are running an institution somewhere. So I'm trying to say, Chair, really, what courses, you know, practically, if he could say we will train someone with a matric into filling of forms, or we're running a course that helps them to understand the procedure, we have a course that perhaps deals with a clerk that does revenue collection or payments at a service delivery point, where you know that those, you know, so that we understand the linkages of enhancing the service delivery that they are trying to, because their business case is based on that, trying to enhance the service delivery capacity of the servants as such. So you then have to design your courses in such a way that it takes care of that. Now, and that relates to the Batopil situation. We all agree that Batopil is a strategy to change attitudes of civil servants, and of course, making them account and appraise bad and good behavior of the servants. Now, you know, if we could see in example the courses that have done this, I thought, Chair, I heard him now. I was going to ask this question because I knew Samdi had its own problems. Now he says we migrated from Samdi to Palima. Samdi was South African, what?
Management Development
Institute. Then I still need to I don't know, check, because I don't have documents in front of me. But if he could say this Palima, is this a suit or is it a short of something? You know, it's abbreviation of something, and if that can be said, so that we understand, maybe we will find the intention and the purpose properly. If this Palima thing is said in full. But Chair, the other point that I needed to make is the fact that Chair is also saying that they are repositioning, and it's still a plan to reposition. So what is currently happening? Let's hear what. Because, Chair, the question then that arises, Samdi was changed and he was referring to something like 2005 or 2006, but some years back, so 2 years back at the most, where decisions were taken around Samdi and the new agency and all that. I might be wrong, so he could correct me, Chair. Now, in between the two, this period, what is happening? What process is undertaken? Is it designing of new courses? Is it intake of? Are there people that are on board now that are being trained? you're getting a new civil servant now. They've advertised, for instance, Chair, for correctional posts and all that. What's going to happen? You just take those people in. They've applied with Z83, and the matric. They come in, and then you know, if we, I think that's the kind of information, Chair, that we require, so that we see the value of Parliament. The other question, Chair, is the issue of vulnerable groups. If in the courses, in the training, it does help them to be able to deal with the with that, with servicing and understanding the specific needs of the vulnerable groups. I'm saying that, Chair, because that relates to how do you keep, I mean, the staff would, the civil servants would then be able to handle the elderly, able to handle people who with certain disabilities, mentally and maybe blind and deaf and all that. It's not being able to do sign language or grailing or whatever, but just to give that care that and courtesy that that goes with the, if it's part of the training. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, you know, I was shocked when I heard that this department that was leading all the departments to do away with consultants is still using a lot of consultants, because that is the information we're getting. And I might agree with my colleague here that this seems to be the slowest department to transform. I mean, decisions were taken in 2005. We're in 2011. You're still moving around with plans and plans and plans. How do we achieve what we have spoken about earlier if we're still planning and planning and planning? I'm not sure if you're going to achieve what you're saying by 2040. If you could not do it in the last...
If you can pick, because it was 1 o'clock, food behind, and also let's just be a bit economic with time, yes. But at the same time, you can stand up and grab something so that, right.
Chair, maybe let me just ask this short question. How come that you're still, as you are indicating, that as this department you are still using a lot of consultants, and whereas a government decision was that let's try and do away with consultants so that we can do a lot of work ourselves and save money to can do something else with that particular money rather than spending a lot of money on consultants? Because you see, if you're using a lot of consultants, it is you who is promoting outsourcing, because you are promoting outsourcing if you are using a lot of consultants, and that's where the problem is. Maybe the next issue is now, if you are not using these institutions you referred to, like the universities or whatever, for training, what is it that you are doing? Are you going to do that training internally? Have you built that? Are you building that capacity to can train on your own? And so that we understand what is it that you want to do. Because you are a middleman of the of departments. You go in and get another middleman as a consultant before you get that particular training. Yes, if you take the three, government is losing a lot of money in terms of that process, because that, you should have been doing that work, but you are going out and looking for consultants to do that, because you should have been doing that work on behalf of the department. Maybe if you can clarify us and explain what is exactly happening. Sure, thank you.
Chair, it's a complex situation, but because Director General and myself were colleagues in the previous dispensation, I think we think very same. Because we were
which is previous dispensation?
Well, when integrated in the Defence Forces, he was part of the Integration Committee, as I was. And we were faced with a lot of similar challenges, and I have a lot of confidence in his
capacity as strategic thinking of training and integrating training programs. Unfortunately, the technicality and the complexity of training of different user systems and higher user systems is not a question of getting people together, because you know you need some specialists. For example, there is a directive from the Department of the National Treasury that by 2013, all the people in the working in the financial departments must be trained according to certain curriculums regarding the MFA. And let me tell you, sir, if we think that we can use the institution of the government without making use of universities and, well, you can call it consultants, then we are not going to make the break, because the great, and we maybe, if we are lucky, 20% of the municipal officials will be trained by 2013. But I think it's not a question of using consultants or not using consultants. We must have frameworks within where we, when we give them the work to do, so that we can keep them liable for what they do and for the end results that they have. And I think that's what I see. That is exactly what Palma is looking for, to try and get those things under control and get standards so that we can use it. But one of the other problems that we have in this kind of people, you train people, and as soon as they have been trained, they disappear. They're going to greener pastures, and then you must retrain them once again. And that is the practicality that we are facing in the development state. But I think I'm very positive what I'm hearing this morning, because if we are not going to embark on training of our government, especially our local government, we will end up elsewhere. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Can we get responses?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thought-provoking questions from honorable members. Honorable Chair, I think when I started, I said, you know, I am not sure how far was the committee briefed about the background of this institution.
No, Chief, can you respond to this question?
Yes.
Because we are not in a workshop for now. Just respond. Okay.
The confusion was, the first question was on the issue of this presentation's relevance to the Batuqueli principles and the expectation that it was going to address those issues. And I started by saying the first presentation that we prepared until this morning was the Batuqueli, what is Palama doing with courses up to date as it relates to Batuqueli, and that presentation was ready. But it was only this morning when we were told, no, the committee's expectation is an update on Palama, that we had to make the new presentation this morning, and this is the presentation that we have. What I'm saying is that, Honorable Chair, we will also leave this presentation with details as to what is it that is Palama doing, but I will talk to the type of programs that we are doing to support Batuqueli. The first program is that we have the front office training as a response of courses that we are doing in relation to Batuqueli. We do Project Kaedu. Now, Project Kaedu says those that are in the offices get, especially senior managers, they get the first module that empowers them in terms of the requirement of the skills, but then they go outside to where service has to be delivered. They are deployed at that service delivery point so that they can experience some of the challenges. That is Project Kaedu. We are also doing the public service induction course. Say those members that are recruited and they come into to the public service. What is the public service? What are those expectations? We do that. For senior managers, we have a course called Wamkelekile. When they enter the public service, it is an induction course for senior managers. Public service induction is for non-SMS members that they go through. In terms of the back office, we are doing, in terms of attitude training, we are promoting the anti-corruption
as a course in the public service. We do that training for secondly also for the practitioners of anti-corruption. That is to make sure that departments can have that minimum capacity within the department. We also focus on the supply chain, the training in terms of supply chain management, because that's where actually corruption happens. At an external level, we do excellent customer service courses for the frontline staff. We do service delivery improvement courses. We are also at an entry point, have a course that we call Breaking Barriers to Entry, where we target through with the National Youth Agency a number of graduates that are employed, and we are running those courses across the country. Those are some of the courses that we are doing to make sure that the attitudes and we inculcate them. Now, as to what is the meaning of Palama, yes, indeed, Palama is a Sotho word, but Palama is an acronym that stands for Public Administration Leadership and Management Academy. As I said, it was established in August 2008, and its establishment was as a result of a 2005 question that was raised by Cabinet to the Minister of Public Service and Administration, which wanted to ascertain as to whether the South African Management and Development Institute by then had the requisite capacity to deliver training to the public service. And I have said, as a response to that, a ministerial committee was established, made recommendations, and those recommendations, Cabinet pronounced on them, and when it pronounced on them, it made certain recommendations. And those recommendations, among them, was that there must be an establishment of an academy, and that academy should actually it should actually facilitate the training. So the current scenario that you have of the current business model, it is a model as it was presented by Cabinet. It was a model that says Palama as an institution from somebody must facilitate the training. Now, and I have said, Honorable Chair, that yes, indeed, the problem statement, and if you allow me, I will just go back to the issue of the problem statement that I pointed out. And in that problem statement, I have actually identified the issue of consultant as a problem. And I was trying to update the committee that we have identified why is our training not having that impact, and we are addressing that thing, and I have said that we are building an on-board capacity. And I have said we never said we will do away with those institutions of higher learning, but I have said we need a structured relationship with institutions of higher learning, not to take anybody on board without actually looking as to the particular competency. But I've always also said that the usage of the skills of those that are in the public service themselves. Because do I really need a graduate from the University of Cape Town to teach somebody public finance management, or must we use
the question was, why is it that this leading department that was telling other departments that let's do away with consultants, that you are now identifying it as a problem, you know, because you are leading this process, you see, and that's what I'm worried about. Now you have just identified it. You know, a decision has long been taken by government that let us do away with consultants. Now you are identifying it now as a problem. Why now?
Let me finish the first question. I'm going to give my colleagues to make an input in that regard. Maybe you want to come in on that one.
Honourable members, I just want to clarify the question of consultants that the DG is referring to. When the DG was appointed about a year ago, immediately he stopped all the contracts that were there in terms of supporting organisation, the consultants that were there. What he's actually referring to is the model of trainers, we had a model, like the old model of Samji, the new, the Balama, was that Balama would utilize higher education institutions. Balama would utilize what it's called independent individual contractors. Those independent individual contractors are specialists in various courses, but they are contracted as individuals. That is why he's referring to them as consultants, which we have identified and are saying we need to do away with those and have on-board capacity. I just wanted to clear that. It's not consultants in the, who come and assist department to do their strategic planning, whatever. We're saying those individual independent contractors are specialists. Like if an individual in here is a specialist in supply chain management, that individual, what, in terms of that model, would be appointed to roll out training on supply chain management. So the consultants referred to here are trainers who are individuals. But we're saying in this new model, we need to do away with that. We still need to have our own onboard capacity. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, no, I think it's understandable, but you are right. Must be clear, because you would avoid such questions. But if you write in such a way that it's like it is nebulous, they will ask questions, and the question might be relevant. But when you answer, it's another thing, which clarify, of course, the intention of the question. So maybe the way you write the reporting, the cost, what cost and recovery model is too expensive. The reason consultant, there will be a question. So the questions were relevant. Maybe you need to, as you write this report, or as you articulate your knowledge, you need to be in such a way that it doesn't bring more and more questions from the members.
I think you're correct, because you see, the point is, if we are told now that consultants are a problem, yeah? You never told us that a year ago when you were appointed, you realized that and you did away with them. You're telling us now that this is the problem, and the question we're raising is government has long taken a decision, and this particular department has been leading, telling other departments to do away with consultants. You see? Now, you can't come today to us and say, I've just identified that situation now. You see, you can't do that. But we take the answer. We are not satisfied. We are not satisfied, but we take the answer.
Just in terms of a clarification, in terms of the separation of the departments, Palama is a department on its own and DPSA is a department on its own. And DPSA comes up with the policies, but it would be more the ministry that one would have to be addressing in relation to that particular oversight role. Because Department of DPSA would come up with the policy, but it would be what happened at that particular point in time in terms of the Palama model when it was established that allowed it to have those consultants, and that is the history that we'd have to be addressing.
Let me share. I'm able to share this. Yes, let me share. I think when we met last during the annual briefing, we were not told about the separation. We're told, but we're engaging the department, including the aspect of Palama. So the separation thing is something that happens in the department, I'm sure. But when we get that briefing, when we're at that venue, we just seen the delegation from the ministry clarifying Palama, single public service, whatever. But now we understand that it becomes a branch, we think, or a department or whatever, I don't know. But now, the question is not about it's not condensed yet. We are only getting clarity, and you are clarifying, you are noting certain things, and you also accept what you are explaining. It's not disputed, because you are doing working with those things. So I'm trying to avoid as if there is a competition here. There's no competition. It's just that the parliament wants to know certain things from the executive. You represent the executive. In essence, they were supposed to be having a minister.
but we're told that we must also accept management, HOT, whatever, at some stage, because we're worried that sometimes when we raise issues that we're not happy about, you can't take decisions. And you may not be able to go to the minister and say, do this, because you don't have those powers. But we would accept that. Some of the issues that we are seeing, so are easy. It's just a matter of how we relate to each other now. Sometimes you deviate from the principle or from the presentation, put politics here, and all sorts of things. And that's how we work. But I wouldn't like this, you know, what do you call the like a dialogue. Then just clarify where you clarify, and then let the members ask questions where they are. Some questions say, no, no, we'll take them to the ministry. You don't have to labor to say this is the point. You don't have to do that. That's what members raising their head.
No, you have clarified the situation, because presently, Palama's budget is in your department. You know, when you told us last time, was money comes into your department and you need to transfer to Palama. Now, Palama does not account to us. It is the department, you see, in terms of the budget situation. And that's why we're asking this particular question. Because the department, at the end of the day, is also responsible for Palama. Because it's the same minister.
I see that it is 12-1 now, Chair, and we are still having a few other issues that we are facing.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for that. Can you just summarize on issues of concern? And don't write a composition letter. Just say this, so that we get other aspects. Last time we were disturbed by other committee which wanted to go at exactly 1 o'clock.
I think the quick one, Chair, is the issue of on issues relating to vulnerable groups. The two quick ones is that on gender mainstream, on the issue of women, yes, indeed, there is training in that regard that we are doing. And there is also a program on Braille that the program that we are doing with the legislature here, legislative capacity building program. And in that regard, we have also been requested, and we have developed a module that we are doing on Braille. We're also doing that with cabinet. Well, on the issues of elderly people out there, I think the values that we are inculcating in the public service as a contact point, we hopefully think that it will change their attitudes and make sure that they do that. I must say also the on the question of on board, whether we have the capacity on board, yes, indeed, what we are saying currently, in the current model, we are saying that we must have on board capacity, but also use other public servants who are not necessarily at Palama because of their expertise, but also take into account the relations, the structured partnership with other institutions of specialists. Okay, let me pause there.
I think we are satisfied, and maybe I want to make a recommendation to the department. I don't know how that program can develop. At one stage, I think we must have a day's meeting, like a workshop, especially with this Palama issue, so that we must also be able to articulate like you the Palama issue. Just have to have more deeper and deeper. Isn't that now we deal with issues in terms of context? We would want to understand the real context, programs and whatever. Even though we know that we are not administrators, but I think it will assist us to take it forward as we debate. If that can be noted, the department and our committee secretary would have to engage even if it's not now, even if after elections, where there's time, then let's meet, let's engage each other, and then you will be doing what Balama is wanting to do to both the politicians, the administrators, whatever. You will be taking us to school if that is taken. Thank you very much. Can you get another please? Whoever dealing with a challenge, recommendations, we know that you have a lot of information on these issues, but you could deal with that, yes.
Chair, thank you very much. I'm not too sure, really, but I'll try my level best. Maybe one option is to talk through it. Thank you very much, Chair, and the honorable members, for this opportunity to appear before you to do this presentation, but also for me to visit Parliament for the first time. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
You're
welcome.
I wanted to do that extension, perfect. No, I've been pulled into the Department of Public Service and Administration on a project basis to manage the setting up of the Special Anti-Corruption Unit up until June this year. Now, that's by way of background, and that issue, Chair, is going to be relevant to also some of the issues that we will talk to. Now, what appears on the screen here is just basically the outline of what the presentation basically covers. But on the point of the legislative mandate is that the minister, through Section 3 and Chapter 2 of the Public Service Act, has a responsibility to establish norms and standards relating to labor relations, ethics, integrity, conduct, and anti-corruption in the public service, and to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of the public service and its service delivery to the public. The minister shall give effect to this function by making regulations, determinations, and directives, and by performing any other acts provided for in the Act. Now, briefly, what also informed the setting up of the Special Anti-Corruption Unit is it's essentially a collection of various activities in the area of research. For instance, you had the Auditor General reports. You also had the research done by the very same Department of Public Service and Administration. You also had research conducted by the Interministerial Committee on Governance and Administration. And all these particular reports, including, by the way, reports from the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, as well as the reports from the Minimum Anti-Corruption Compliance Indices, point to one particular direction, point to particular gaps that exist in enforcing measures around issues of corruption, fight against corruption, but also, importantly, the issue of coordination amongst different agencies as well as departments. Now, the issue also that has been identified is the question of insufficient investigative capacity within departments around corruption-related cases, the question of lack of accountability by managers to effectively deal with cases referred to departments. Thirdly, also the research work identifies to lack of clarity in certain cases as to who should initiate investigations between internal or external and so on. These are some of the issues that have arose from the research work. And on the basis of this, the reaction then was the launch of the Special Anti-Corruption Unit. We launched it on the 25th of November 2010 by the Minister of Public Service and Administration. And at that launch, up to this point, we said that our vision is to achieve a corrupt-free public service, and our mission is to provide a coordinated anti-corruption enforcement framework to support the national integrity system through, amongst others, effective investigations, disciplinary processes, comprehensive management of strategic information. Now, management of strategic information relates to, for instance, how the question of how we have to manage information that is surrendered to ourselves as a unit around allegations of corruption. Now, those people are whistleblowers or potential whistleblowers, and how do we then have got to develop measures to try and protect them? There seems to be quite a trend in certain cases where whistleblowers do get victimized in one form or the other, was the sudden that information relating to corruption. On the issue of strategy objectives of the unit, we are to achieve an effective and integrated management of investigation of corruption cases in the public service, effective and also integration insofar as disciplinary proceedings relating to corruption in the public service, also an integrated legal and advisory support where it would be necessary for us to do so, also looking at the integrated manner in which strategic information would have to be managed. And we also have identified indicators such as the reduction of corruption incidents, increasing a percentage around issues of following up on the disciplinary cases and concluding those particular conclusion of such cases and so on, and the time spent that takes us to be able to achieve such. Now, on the outcomes, one of the major things that we need to achieve is the question of how the extent to which we begin to centralize the management of anti-corruption cases and development of uniform standards and issue of enhancing capacity to deal with corruption cases, increasing reporting on corruption, but also importantly is to improve the rating of the country, South Africa, insofar as the global anti-corruption indices, and also contributing to improving the global perception on the issue of corruption in South Africa. The issue of the need to restore trust and confidence amongst the citizens around the issues of a fight against corruption, improving delivery of government services. The one thing, Chair, I would want to touch upon, I've said in the next few months up until June, the question of a special anti-corruption unit is managed as a project, because in June the intention is to also set it up as a government entity. So as a result of which we are also, whilst dealing with the issues of investigations and disciplinary cases where we are also dealing with the issue of a feasibility study, which has got to take us towards the establishment of such an entity in June as a state entity with a corporate image and whatever. But also we have started working with the Special Investigation Unit as well as National Treasury around key outstanding cases that have been identified. We've also started training presiding officers on the 15th of February to the 18th of February with Palama, the public. Palama. And leadership and management, academy, they've assisted us in training 20 presiding officers, precisely because we need to respond to the issue of the 30 priority cases identified from also the side of the SIU and National Treasury. We are also working with other state agencies, be it the National Intelligence Agency, the South calling out a communication, no, not a communication, stakeholder management program. We will be beginning to meet with various stakeholders, for instance, the formations and organizations outside, on the issue of mobilizing an effort in the fight against corruption and also assistance that we would require from time to time. The second phase is the feasibility study, which has got to look at the whole question of a legislative mandate analysis that we would require as a unit, but also service delivery model, a governance arrangement, as well as a funding a model for a state entity eventually in June. Now, there is a question that has been consistently raised in different forms and so on. Why do we... What makes the Special Anti-Corruption Unit different from... oh, by the way, Chair, the Special Anti-Corruption Unit will be called WASP in June. WASP. WASP, not West. W-A-S-P-S. You hardly come across a WASP in the Free State, Chair. Sorry. But it's W-A-S-P-S. WASP. Okay. Now, the Special Anti-Corruption Unit, I'm sorry, Chair, thanks. The Special Anti-Corruption Unit, its mandate is to focus primarily on coordination of investigations and disciplinary processes relating to corruption cases in the public service. The second area is that beyond June this year, we have to put measures in place to centralize the management of investigations and enforcement of anti-corruption measures. And this could possibly require legislative amendments. And this is the issue that the feasibility study itself will look at resolving. I think I've spoken to collaborative efforts that we're involved in, but of importance, there's a project that is taking place now in the Eastern Cape affecting the Department of Health. We're working with a multi-agency working group, which is a National Treasury Initiative, as well as the Anti-Corruption Task Team, which is a criminal justice cluster initiative, and then ourselves is this particular unit. We have already moved there in January this year, and we have picked up a number of issues that would have to be followed through, including supply chain management issues, as well as the issues relating to human resources and so forth. And we have begun developing work streams for each particular agency to begin to provide assistance and support insofar as those areas are concerned. I think I've also spoken about the question of stakeholder management and so on, and the work that is that is beginning to unfold. The one point, though, and this is the point that in the process, by just some form of a conclusion on this matter, is that the one thing that we want to emphasize, particularly in stakeholder engagement and management issues, is that the question of a fight against corruption is a matter of social consciousness. In other words, it's something that society as a whole has got to be mobilized around, and therefore it requires this kind of a societal effort. And therefore, when we engage with stakeholders, we will also want them to be able to identify I don't want to call it a niche, but the kind of role and support that they may want to play or provide in the fight against corruption. So briefly, that's where we are. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Just before this, can you note that, and then they just brief us in 5 minutes on the other last element. Whether we would have no strike.
what we're requested to do, just to give a briefing in case of the preparations when coming to salary negotiation. We want to confirm the salary negotiation has started already at the PSCPC level. We are also anticipating to engage on the multi-term, as we know that organized labor only want the single term, which creates a problem for us because we don't want to engage each and every year. If we've got a multi-term, at least it gives us a breath in case of 3 years. But those are the debates that we are having within the PSCPC. We are also looking at concluding the salary negotiations before the municipal elections in May. That is what we have envisaged in case of the process map and the way we have planned our things. We are also with the parties within the PSCPC. We are having what we call a Beechwood Declaration, which is Beechwood 1, which is going to guide the rules of engagement so that we avoid what happened last year. So each parties are committed to that Beechwood 1. It's available in the website. We can also send it where it outlines in case of the rules of engagement, the fair part of it, and also parties respecting each other in case of the engagement. It also outlines the management of the negotiations within the negotiation process. Thus, I said I'm not going to get much into the details. I'm going to report on three issues when coming to the current status. Currently, the PSCPC constitution is observed in case of where parties table at the council and the consolidation is made at the level of the PSCPC. And then after that, according to the constitution, the secretary of the council calls the parties and give a determination in case of the timetable for negotiations where the parties will be able to see to say this is the date that we are going to start negotiations. But as we said, the way we observe the PSCPC constitution, it means negotiations have already started now. The second way we say, currently there is an information sharing within the PSCPC. Immediately when parties start to table, because as you know, within the PSCPC, it's 8 admitted unions within the PSCPC. Each union will come with its own demand. So now what happens to the council? The council will consolidate all the demands and be able to call the caucuses so that all the parties can have common demand in case of tabling that demand to the employer. This is the process that is happening presently. The PSCPC is managing the caucuses. In case of the constitution, because of the tabling of those demands, the PSCPC will arrange different parties to be able to sit in order to be able to consolidate the document before it can be formally tabled, where the employer will know to say all the unions are demanding 7.5 or 6.5%. Now we are not having any clue in case of the percentage that is being demanded. We'll hear after the PSCPC process has been observed. In case of the PSCPC, immediately after the consolidation of the sharing of information is finalized, the date will be set by the Secretary of the Council. On that date, parties will sit together and be able to agree on the timetable. That is how far we are, Chairperson, in case of the process on coming to salary negotiations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can we quickly engage Honorable Members? Honorable Villafeld, Blue.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to go back to the Special Investigation Unit. What is, will the relationship be between the wasps and the hawks, for example? I got an internet message yesterday, and I think this is applicable to my question. For example, in Durban, in Ekurhuleni, at this stage they are investigating contracts fraud of approximately 17 million and 5 billion in total, where the contracts were revised without making use of the procurement processes from 6.1 million to 15 million, then that was for councillors and all those kind of thing. And I'm not saying it's true, but that is what is reported. For example, if you get this kind of thing, what will the relationship between this unit be and the Hawks who's investigating, and how are we going to get these things together? Because this is, according to what I'm seeing here on the time scale, this is really in terms of the size of the unit. It's a Mickey Mouse organization in relationship to the task that they're going to investigate.
And just to give my indication how we're going to link up with these two organizations. I don't want to use, this is a merit case, that's not what I'm asking. But if you look what the kind of corruption is that we are talking about, I think we need the hell of an army to go and investigate all the corruption at this stage.
Is there any other question concerning negotiations, salaries? Possible that there are issues
will come across some of these things where people have either been investigated by your SIU, for an example, as public servants, and be duly sentenced, but they will still be sitting within the public service. So those are some of the anomalies that you find, and those are the issues that we'll also need to hone into to look at ways and means of effectively dealing with that. Now, it comes naturally, Honorable Bloom, the question of screening. I mean, you can't do otherwise. You have to secure not only your institution but also the process itself, as and when you have to conduct your work. So the question of screening and the manner in which you deal with the recruitment of staff is going to be quite essential. But that's the process that will click in after June 2011. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we can put a comma and then other issues will come as we meet again. Let me just thank the department. Which one? Oh, sorry. We hope that I must quickly close.
No, thanks, Chair, and also thanks for the concern, Honorable Mr. Bloom. So in case of municipal elections, we know in any party you utilize your leverage in case of the engagement. I mean, when you talk about bargaining, you talk about the power of bargaining. So now immediately when one party realizes that there is a way I can leverage my engagement, you end up as a government paying more heavy price on that matter because of that. I can give an example in case of World Cup 2010. So some of the chaos that happened, it was because of the World Cup, people putting it as a leverage in case of the engagement. So now our process map in case of planning is that it should not go towards the where people can be able to utilize it as leverage. Because, you know, during that time, people start to put a lot of issues. You start to see service delivery protests, but where you know there is a service delivery. But because of the wage issue, they use it as a leverage in case of the... it becomes a bargaining tool for them and also a bargaining power. That is why we are not envisaging for the negotiation to go towards that period. On the issue of budget share, we are always budgeting. We are also having what we call a rock bottom. That is why we said during this time there is a consolidation of the demand. You put it in mind to say it might happen that the unions might demand 4.5. But at the level of the political, because we've got what you call a political a settlement, where you put a certain percentage of money that in case where we don't reach settlement, this is what we can resolve. And that one usually would need the political management in case of dealing with such issues. But it happens that when you bargain, the more they say, if you say 6.5 and then they say we need another 0.5, and you take long, you bring that 0.5, they'll say there's still more. They will need that more. You will keep on budgeting each and every time until you become very tough to say this is the government can't do in case of the salary wage bill. That is why when we look at our salary wage bill, it's now at 237 billion, which is too much in case of the state. How do you manage that state? Because in 3 years' time, when you talk about 5-6% in case of the increment, it became chaos. Because you can't have, in case of the goods and services, but only to find out the personal expenditure, it's more than in case of the goods and services where you should be able to service the country. It becomes bad. You talk about synchronizing negotiations with the budget. It's right. That is how we have planned. When we look at the Beachwood one, it also talks about that to say before the budget can take place, we should be able to deal with the budget issue and start negotiation so that when we reach there, we are able to influence the budget of the state to say this is the situation, how much is needed, so that in case of any changes, before even the medium-term expenditure framework or whatever it might be in case of the planning of the government, already we know that we can be able to afford that. But the situation in the public service is that we are having 8 unions. Those guys, before they reach an agreement to consolidate their demands, they take long. And there's a competition between the unions inside. You understand? It's not simple, unlike where you deal with the Salga, you deal with some when only two unions. For them to reach agreement, it can take 2 to 3 to say, look, we need 7%. But for the union to convince each other to say, guys, let's start with 15%, 8 of them, it will take so many months. So that is why it delays this thing of the synchronizing with what you call it. As we are saying now, their demands are not yet consolidated. Other unions have brought their demands. So when we talk about the process map in case of dealing with that, it means the secretary must be able to sit down each and every time, arrange caucuses to say, guys, go and talk and come with the common paper. And then so that when the engagement comes, the state knows that the demand is of 50% and we can be able to engage on that matter. Did I answer all the chair?
You will never answer all of this. Thanks, chair. It's impossible.
Chair, he has just indicated that the state is paying too much, but now they want to add local government on board. They want to bring local government on board. How are they going to cope with it?
You'll go and research and answer. We'll meet. But let me thank you very much for this engagement. It has been very fruitful. And we hope will maximize that at least 70% of the issues that we prioritize must be met. We know that it won't be 100%. That's why there is management and leadership. It's for these purposes. And I hope we'll meet again. We'll pass our remark to our ministry to say we met, and they will be preparing for the annual budget report so that we must come in rustle again in the vessel. Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks everyone, including whoever is absent. Until we meet again, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.